Let me tell you a little bit about Teddy before we begin our conversation. He was born in Jacksonville, Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi,
sorry. After working with local bands there in the 1930s, he spent some time in Detroit and then moved to California. He subsequently played with Benny Carter, Clifford Brown and Max Roach, Benny Goodman. He also, during this period, led or co-led bands with Howard McGee. McGee and Teddy Edwards played together in an octet in the 1940s along with Charlie Parker and Sonny Criss. He's recorded with Sonny Criss and with Benny Goodman, Sarah Vaughan, Ray Charles, Milt Jackson, Dexter Gordon, King Pleasure, among others. He's also written and arranged for Lorez Alexandria, who's also in the studio, and we'll be talking with her in a few minutes and also hearing some of her music. Teddy's also arranged and composed for Booker Irvin, Milt Jackson, Ray Charles. He's a featured soloist in the soundtracks for the films Any Wednesday and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? He's also the subject of a film that was produced by Steve Allen, who is also in Philadelphia this week and was on Fresh Air a little earlier in the week. Teddy's recent albums are featured on Xanadu Records, and recent reissues of his work are featured on Onyx Records, which is a subsidiary of Muse Records. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here, and a pleasure to have you in Philadelphia.
Oh, it's going to be a really nice visit. I can see it coming.
Okay. What I'd like to do, Teddy, is like talk about the past and like work our way up to the present. Your family was a musical family. Your father was a trombonist.
My father played all of the popular instruments, trombone, trumpet, clarinet, violin, whatever, you know. But I never met my father until I was 12 years old, and I was already playing when I met him.
Oh.
Yeah, I lived with my grandparents, my mother and me, you know, and my grandfather played bass. In fact, he was one of the first acoustic bass players I ever heard. Most of the guys during that time, they were using the sousaphone or the tuba for the bass part, you know. He's really one of the pioneers of the string bass, really, in the jazz field.
What was his name?
Henry C. Reed.
Mm-hmm. Is he recorded?
No. That was before. He might have been on some of the old blues records, but you know, it's not of any repute.
Did he teach you how to play your first instrument?
No, what happened was there was a saxophonist living at my house. But before that, my mother and my grandmother, they talked saxophone to me before I even started school. They had brainwashed me about saxophone because my father played, and they had me idolizing my father, you know. And the band used to rehearse at my house, and they would sit me by the saxophone section, you know, way before I started school. So I was saxophone brainwashed, you know. So eventually, the fellow that was living with us, he had a second instrument, and my mother bought it from him, and she washed and ironed his clothes to pay for my lessons, which were 35 cents a week. And after 6 months, he told me, he said, well, look, I don't know anything else to teach you, you know. So you're on your own. So I was on my own up until 1948. I did 3 months of study in Los Angeles. Until then, it was all a matter of trial and error and listening to people and listening to music and studying the best that I could on my own.
You, when you started playing, I think, also played clarinet.
Right. Well, I took up the clarinet around about 14 on my own, and I had started studying orchestration. In fact, I wrote my first regular dance band orchestration that the notes came out right when I was 14.
Wow. Do you play clarinet anymore? It seems to be like an instrument that's like faded from contemporary jazz.
It's such a hard instrument. You know, it asks for your blood, believe me. It looks simple, but it's a very difficult instrument. So a lot of people shy away from it. Like, when I came along, you almost had to play like Sonny Stitt, Wardell, Rudy Ruther. We were all fine clarinet players for that, you know, when we came up around Detroit. And somehow, the guys just started leaving it alone. You know, because you got to practice it every day hard, else it'll let you know, you know.
When you started playing in bands before you moved to the West Coast, what kind of bands were they? What kind of music did you play?
Well, like, the first band I played with was Doc Pommel and his Royal Mississippi, and that was an 18-piece orchestra, all adults, you know. It was no child's orchestra. And I was playing third, and before long I was playing the lead. And I played with another band around home named Don Dunbar. Good band, had good writers, you know.
How
you'd be surprised.
Old were
you then? I was like 13 and 14. I first took my first tour when I was 12, went out on the road with a band.
Now, that's really young. I mean, it doesn't seem like jazz musicians get started that young anymore. I don't see any anymore.
Well, nowadays they are starting them out young because they have the good teachers and the good equipment and everything. But I really did it the hard way, but I was determined. you know, to play that instrument.
Well, what was life like for you? I could see you like showing up at a bar and then, you know, like be, you know, playing in a place where there's alcohol, but you know, if it was a bar or something,
well,
like not
the,
being
in
able
those
to
days,
drink.
Well, they didn't have any laws about children not being able to come in.
Yeah,
you know, I worked all kind of places with different people, little combos and what have you, and it didn't matter, you know.
Well, you got a little older and then moved out to the...
I went to Detroit when I was about 16, and I worked the finer clubs around there, some of the really fine jobs, you know, because I could play very good for a youngster, you know. And I had the better jobs around Detroit when I was a kid, 16 years old. You know, that was before, when Yusuf Lateef and Milt Jackson, all of them, they're just trying to get the act together, you know. Sonny Stitt was around there, Wardell, Lucky Thompson. But I seen them had a little jump on all of them, maybe except Rudy Rutherford, the clarinetist, Rudy Rutherford and Sonny Stitt. They had a little bit more experience than I had at the time, you know. But we all came up around there pretty much the same period, early 40s. In fact, I was the first guy to teach Yusuf Lateef to change it to a song.
When did you start, learning bop and learning the whole new jazz language? Because you were playing when you were 12, and there was...
Well,
you know,
see, during that period, when this thing was in its embryo stage, I was out on the road with different bands and guys like Charlie Parker. He was with Mike Shan and then Andy Kirk. Different bands they had. So we used to meet up out on the road and this thing, when it was first started to make the change, well, I just happened to be in the change. You see, so the best thing I had going for me was that I had a good harmonic knowledge. I studied harmony real early. You know, when I first heard guys talking about guys playing chord styles, I said, well, let me look into that, you know. So I learned the chords. That's a very valuable thing. You learn those chords thorough as soon as you can when you take up music, because that's one of the main ingredients of music. Well, it's the number three ingredients. First is rhythm, next is melody, then the harmony. Learn the harmony, push your way ahead.
When you started playing with Howard McGhee, how did you meet up with him?
Well, I had met Howard in Detroit. We came out of the same band in Detroit at the Congo Club playing for the top acts, you know, in Detroit. And I left, my mother took a second, I went down to Mississippi, and I ventured down into Florida, down into Tampa with the band, and I ended up being the leader when the leaders were drafted. They appointed me the leader. I was only about, I was 20 years old at that time, and I think that's when Cannonball Adderley his brother and Sam Jones and Buster Cooper and all of them used to stand around outside and listen to me play. You know, you're too young to come in. But anyway, I ventured down through there, and then I left, and Andy Kirk was looking for me. Howard McGhee's with Andy Kirk's band. So I ventured out to California with Ernie Fields' orchestra. In fact, I was supposed to be on my way to New York, and he talked me into joining his band because he said, well, we're going to Washington, and you'll have more money when you get to New York. I said, well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, he said, the guys in the band heard you play, and they want you with the band. I said, good. So my first stop was Pensacola. The next one was Monroe, Louisiana, then Tulsa, Oklahoma, Lincoln, Nebraska, getting farther and farther away from New York. Next stop, Los Angeles.
Is that how you got to L.A.?
Right, that's how I got to L.A. Yeah,
did you stay there?
With Ernie Fields Orchestra. I was playing lead alto with his band. And I left. I came in 44, then I left. I had a very bad cold, and the bus broke down up above Cheyenne, Wyoming. And I had a bad cold. I said, well, now, I'm not going to survive this cold. I'm going to go into bad health. I'm going back to California. So when I got to Dodge City, Kansas, I called Roy Milton. He had told me, the blues singer, he had told me, anytime you get ready, come back to Los Angeles. I'll get you in the union and everything. I said, well, that's where I'm going. I called him, came back to Los Angeles. That's been my home base ever since. Now, Howard McGhee, he was out here with Coleman Hawkins Orchestra at Billy Berg's, one of the fine clubs in Hollywood at the time. And when they finished the job, Coleman went back to New York, and Howard wanted to stay in Los Angeles and form a band. And he couldn't find any tenor players that had the knowledge that he needed to do what he was doing. So he told me, he said, looks like you're going to have to change and start playing tenor, you know, because I want you with the band. So I was eager. I said, well, good. I got a tenor and started playing tenor with his group, you know.
You'd been playing alto.
I'd been playing alto and clarinet up until that time, which was 1945.
What was the year or years, the period of time that you and Howard McGhee and Charlie Parker played together?
That was 1946, during the record band. We had I had four saxophones and a trumpet. You know, we had Sonny Chris, G. Montgomery, and Charlie Parker and I. We were the saxophone section. And we had Bob Kesterson, Earl Eklund playing piano, and Roy Porter playing drums, and Howard McGhee playing the trumpet.
Did you ever get to record with that group?
Didn't record with that band, you know.
Why?
Well, it was during the record band. we weren't allowed to record during that period. It was union thing.
Oh, another one of those bands. One of those that things. Completely passed
yeah,
over.
Yeah, completely lost. That was ridiculous because it was such a great outfit.
What was it like playing with Charlie Parker?
Well, we had played together way before that. You were like jamming together every night, different places. And he was probably the most magnetic individual I ever met. And besides playing music, he knew so many other things. People don't have any idea how brilliant this man was. Walter Winchell knew, because he called him the eighth wonder of the world, because of his knowledge of many different things, not just music, And a memory, like you wouldn't believe his memory, In fact, the first time I saw him with Billy Eckstein's band, they had been together 4 days. I saw him on the fourth day down in Lakeland, Florida, and he was sitting on the library. After 4 days, he's sitting on the book. That's how his mind was,
I think he moved back to... Where were you playing when you were together with the Octet?
We were in Los Angeles, but the last time he was in San Francisco... I took him to the train station. His last day on California soil, because I was working at Bob City in San Francisco, and he was working at the Say When. I was working after hours, and when he finished his gig, he would come and play with me. So when I get off at 6, we would go and play chess all day. He loved to play chess, and we would just sit over the chessboard the rest of the day practically.
Then he came east after that.
Yeah, right. He came into Chicago and into New York after that.
Mm-hmm. And the growth of bebop and all of this is usually something that associated with New York and with the East Coast. Were you ever tempted to come back east?
That was one of my maybe one of my mistakes, because I didn't leave when everybody else was going. But see, what was happening, John Coltrane and Jimmy Heath and Stanley Turner, they were back east studying me, because I was way ahead of the tenor players in 1945 and 46. If you check out my Up in Dodo's Room with Howard McGee, that's the first record that a tenor player made that didn't come from the Lester Young or the Coleman Hawkins School. In fact, I wasn't aware of until Fash Navarro told me, "So, man, do you realize you changed the course of history?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Blues and up in Dodo's Room." He said, "That's the first one to come up playing different. Then here comes the rest of them, Sonny Rollins and James Moody and all of them after that one, they heard that sound." But I was out here and wasn't getting the publicity from New York, But right today, Stan and his brother, Milt Jackson, Percy, all those guys can sing all those solos note for note that I recorded back around 45 and 46.
Do you listen to those records still?
No.
Do you
I
have
can't
cabbies
stand
over
to hear them?
Why? Why?
Well, I was a struggling kid of 21 at the time on instrument.
Do you have people who you consider to be your influences, or do you think that your style developed
pretty independently? I never really copied anybody to any degree at all, because the way I really started as a soloist, the pianist could call the chords to me, and I could transpose them to my instrument as fast as he would call them, and I would just play up and down until eventually I got so I could make them make sense and start hearing it. But my early idols were Johnny Hodges was my first idol, Benny Carter, Willie Smith. Oh, I could go on and on, Johnny Bothwell. I could go on naming saxophone, Tab Smith. The alto players were my thing, Naturally, I admired Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and John Chewbery and all those guys, And later on, the later said Dexter and Wardell and all them. But I imagine the whole scene had influenced me. I just came up with the scene, just came up as part of it. But actually, as far as me really trying to play like somebody, never have I tried to do that. Because I had the harmonic thing going, and I could just do what I could do until I could make it make sense,
Teddy, before we continue our conversation, I'd like to go back to the recording that we've been listening to and play another track from
Why
it.
Why not?
This is a track of That Old Black Magic. And again, Teddy Edwards is featured on tenor sax, Duke Jordan at the piano, Larry Ridley bass, and Freddie Waits drums. Would you want to say a few words about this, Teddy, before we hear it?
About this particular date? Nothing in particular. It was just... went into New York and did one of those Xanadu albums,
Okay, well, let's hear this recording of That Old Black Magic.
Thank you.
Just heard That Old Black Magic as featured on a Xanadu recording called The Inimitable Teddy Edwards, who was featured on tenor sax. Teddy Edwards is my guest in the studio now. Well, Teddy, we had been talking a little bit about some of the bands that you've played with. Now, you've played in bands that were led by other people, and you've led your own band, so you've kind of been on both ends of that. Sometimes when I'm reading, when I'm reading a book written by, like, a jazz critic or historian or something, they'll sometimes refer to the band leader as like the employer,
from an academic point of view, he is the employee. But now music, you play music together. If I'm the lead of a group, I'm just part of the group, really. I just happen to be the one officiating the business. But the music you play together, you know. So if you playing with me, I'm playing with you. You play with, not for.
what's your attitude towards the people who are playing in a band with you, as far as like the kinds of rules or whatever you're gonna like set down?
Well,
for
the
them
first place,
the
I would I, the guys that I would choose, I would feel that they were pretty much responsible and try to create an atmosphere where everybody is eager to give their best. That's the main function of a leader, is to get the best out of the people around him. Yes, he's not a leader. You see, he's a so-called leader. Now, there's guys that are, slave drivers and all of that, but they don't get the best out of the people. See, people have to want to do for you to play music. They got to want to play it, else you don't get the best out of them, you know. And we were talking a few minutes ago about one of my good friends from way back, very fine pianist and songwriter. He wrote one of Nat Cole's hits, and he was also the owner of the company that Larez and I did some work for. In fact, one of her better albums is on his Pizzazz label, defunct Pizzazz label. His name is Paul Gayton. And he's a great pioneer of talent. Annie Laurie, remember Since I Fell for You?
Yeah.
That was one of his big ones. And he's really a great guy. And Larez was asking me about how soon did I play with Paul. Well, I played with Paul when I was 14 in his band called Paul Gayton and his Sizzling Six. We had a little sextet, you know. And
he sang himself.
And he's a great singer also. Yeah, so great band. He's some of the final musicians. Hank Mobley, a lot of them came out of his band. And
We were talking a bit about the kind of leader that you are when you're the leader of a band.
Well, I don't like to feel that I'm the leader. I'm just one of the guys. You know, we gang up on the music. You know, naturally, I have to make sure things maintain a certain amount of order for us to get a certain amount of continuity. But as far as me really want to be a leader, you know, I just come to work and have some fun, you know. Like, I just performed a concert not too long ago with 18 pieces. We just had a ball. Then I did one last year, July the 1st last year, with 32 pieces that I did, the orchestration, lyrics, composition, the whole works. And we're just like one big happy family, you know.
Well, you've played with a lot of people, some of whom's attitude might not be what yours is towards leading a band. Can you compare like your attitude with someone?
Let me key in on one of the most famous band leaders, Benny Goodman. Now, Benny Goodman has a reputation for having what they call the Ray. All musicians know about the Ray. The Ray is the way he looks at you on the bandstand. You know, you get those daggers going. You know, so Benny, the first time I worked with Benny, I came to rehearsal, and all the musicians were sitting outside because he was playing with the rhythm section. See, before he performs, he plays the rhythm section, then he brings the band in. Right, we in Hollywood, all the big-time musicians sitting outside, afraid to go in the room. So I walked on there and said, wait a minute, he's just got to be another man. So I walked on in and took a seat and set my horn down, you know. And he looked over at me, you know. And then when he finished, then he, you know, I went over and introduced myself to him because I never worked with him. But all these big-time musicians, all they can do is lose the gig. You know, they afraid to come in into the place where the man was, waiting till he finished before they would even open the door, you know. But anyway, to make a long story short, through the process, we became very good friends, you know. In fact, I really think it loosened him up quite a bit, our relationship, really loosened him up, because he got so, he smiled and he was nice to the guys and everything, you know. And one day in New York, he had just finished blowing his top and he looked at me, he says, "How can you sit there and be so relaxed when I'm a nervous wreck?" I said, "Benny, you got to learn how to roll with the punches, man." He said, "You know, you got something there, you know." See, yeah, it's not that important, you know. You got to roll with the punches, you know. And it really helped him to relax. In fact, he had an occasion to really be stiff once. We worked the Melody Land, and Peggy Lee, whom he discovered, had top billing over him, and it kind of messed with his ego a little bit until they played the overture and the people gave him all that applause, then that relaxed him, you know. But at first, he had cause to be, because she had no business having top. She shouldn't have accepted top billing over him. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because of what he had done for her and what he had been in the business, you know. But business people, they go with who's on top at the time, and it's a matter of business, but these things happen, you know. But anyway, I just want to relay that little experience with you. But he was what you call the hard band leader. You know, rehearsal is like the gig to him. No fun or nothing. You know, it's strictly hard business. But eventually, he worked his way out of that, you know.
Do you think you have to be looser? Because you're saying before, you know, you've got to... everyone has to, like, want to play well.
To get the best out of people, you know. They have to want to do it. To give you that extra something, the extra dimension that money cannot buy. You can get it from musicians if you show them respect and show them that you care about them and what they are doing.
Now, you've also played, like, for TV studio bands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what that's like, because from my end, which is the end in my living room, where you just, like, turn on the TV.
Well, that's strictly hard, cold business, you know. Uh-huh. If you don't play it the second time, somebody will be there to take your place. You can miss the first time, but the second time, you got to play it. You see? That's how tough it is. You know, it's strictly by the minute. And it's like a 9-to-5 job. It's very little fun. You know, playing that type of really studio music. You know, now and then you get some music that you enjoy playing. And so they be so happy when they run into a piece of music to play for somebody behind a singer, but the arrangement is good, with substance, you know. Like, they really play the musicians cheap. See, the musicians, when you look up that at the night show, when you look at that band, you're looking at more brains than you see on that show the rest of the night. But they don't respect those brains, because they just musicians, just another tool. But it's more brain sitting up on that bandstand than it is out there behind that desk. You can believe that.
Well, it also seems to me like, you know, in my living room, if I'm watching The Tonight Show or any of those, like, talk shows where you know there's some good people mm-hmm. in the band, but they never get to play. It's like they're more interested in flash. And
you
know,
you notice you never see a musician on any game show or talk show or anything as a guest. Only one, Buddy Rich. Now, that's ridiculous. No kind of game show. You don't see musicians on them. You know, and musicians are some of the most experienced people there is. But somehow they just keep shoving them aside like they're twos, you know. But they are the foundation of the business. Without the music, what you gonna do?
Really,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, the invisible man.
Right, the invisible man, you know. And they really, really need to learn to respect that, you know.
You've been recording recently for Xanadu Records. How did you get hooked up with him?
Don Slidden. Well, he was my producer at Prestige when I was with Prestige. I was on a contract to Prestige, and then he was my producer at Muse when I was with Muse. And then he got his own label together, Xanadu. He approached me about doing some things for him, and so we've had a long relationship. Don Slidden, the producer over there. In fact, he told me that my It's All Right that I did with a sextet. He sent me a magazine article where he stated that he had more fun making that record than any record, and he's recorded everybody you can think of on Prestige. He said that was
That's
his choice of the records that he had recorded, was my sextet thing with Cedar Walton and Jimmy Owens, and, well, you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's All Right, that album.
Ted, I want to thank you very much
for
spending
my
some
pleasure.
Time here on Fresh
Karen,
Air.
Karen, you're doing a very, very fine job. Believe
thank you.
Me. And thanks to WUHY.
Okay,
right?
Well, I've been speaking with Teddy Edwards, and in just a few minutes we're going to speak with Larez Alexandria and hear some of her recordings. But first we're going to hear another track from the Xanadu record, the inimitable Teddy Edwards. This is a recording of Stella by Starlight. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We've just heard Teddy Edwards' recording of Stella by Starlight. Now, tomorrow night, he's going to be performing along with Lorez Alexandria.